You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, September 14th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Jane McAlevey, Senior Policy Fellow at the University of California, Berkeley's Labor Center, author of her most recent, anyway, A Collective Bargain, Unions Organizing and the Fight for Democracy. On the next set of challenges to unionization, then TJ Kitchen, appropriately named organizing director for the Teamsters Joint Council number 43, part of that unionization effort of a Lansing Chipotle. Also on the program, new reporting: Putin rejected a Ukrainian no NATO pledge at the very beginning of the war. Remember that Durham investigation I was harping on yesterday, asking where was the beef? Well, they've taken the beef out of the oven and it doesn't exist. I guess that is not a great way of doing that. The inquiry ending with apparently no further charges. It's been a long 4 years. Republicans freak on Lindsey Graham for reminding everyone that they have an agenda that no one likes. Speaking of which, West Virginia likes it. They pass a new abortion ban there. Freight rail strike still looms as the nation preps for down supply lines. And the anti-democracy advocate wins the New Hampshire Republican Senate nomination. Meanwhile, in Rhode Island, sadly, progressive David Siegel loses his bid for a congressional seat. Washington, D.C. considers pre-qualified registration, which would widely expand the electorate. Pandemic aid cut child poverty in this country in half in 2021. Just reminding everybody, child poverty is just a decision that we choose as a nation to accept. Mike Lindell, the Mind Pillow guy, has his cell phones confiscated by the FBI at a Hardee's. And Jazz Brizak, who we interviewed on this program back in June, the primary driver of the Buffalo, or one of the primary drivers of the Buffalo Starbucks union drive, successful one, which kicked it all off, forced out of Starbucks in retaliation. She's filed a complaint to the National Labor Relations Board. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. It is indeed it is Wednesday, and to contextualize a Wednesday for us, the co-host, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma.
Hello. It is hump day, everybody.
There you go. Your coined phrase.
Yes.
I always let you say it because you did the hard work of making it happen. We're going to break format a little bit, right? We're going to bring in Jane McAlevey. She's got a hard out, and so we want to get her on quick. We'll get to this video afterwards. So we're going to take a quick break and bring Jane on. And then after Jane, we'll be talking to TJ Kitchen on the Chipotle organizing or that has happened in conjunction with the Teamsters. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Jane McAlevey. We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. I want to welcome back to the program Jane McAlevey. She's Senior Policy Fellow at the University of California, Berkeley's Labor Center. Author of, I think, four books, if I remember correctly. But the most recent, if I'm not mistaken, was A Collective Bargain from a couple of years ago. Jane, always great to see you. Thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure. Always good to see you, too.
So you've got a video out on the Nation site that talks about sort of the next iteration of challenges that unions are going to face, broadly speaking, but specifically in the process of building a strong union in a workplace. I want to get to that in a bit, but there's a lot of stuff that is going on that I want to talk to you about first. One, just broadly speaking, I mean, I guess the last time we had you on may have been about 2 years ago for the book. There's been a lot happening in terms of at least it feels this way, in terms of momentum of unionization across the country. Give us your sense and your take on that.
Yeah, there is a heck of a lot going on, and it's exciting. The question is, in some ways, is the national labor leadership prepared to actually capture and channel the rage, frankly, that's going on among American workers? So there's a lot going on. I think there are at least two things happening, broadly speaking. I mean, even right this minute, right? I mean, we've got this headline news this morning about trying to avert a rail strike. And what amazes me about that conversation, and it connects a little bit to the question of, is this really the most pro-union administration, pro-labor administration, which I think we should touch on. But, we've got rail workers asserting their needs for a decent quality of life as essential workers. And you've got the administration and the White House posturing all over the news this morning, freaking out about it's going to cost $2 billion a day to corporations and capital, and it's going to disrupt all this stuff. And it's like, maybe if y'all would actually focus on getting the workers what they need, we wouldn't be having a discussion about $2 billion being disrupted in the supply chain, right? So then we've got, all these burgeoning, exploding, organizing, whether it's at Starbucks, whether it's at Amazon, whether it's at Trader Joe's, Apple, all these sort of newer formations that are taking place right now. And you see the sort of gap between where the energy is and the heat is in the field, like essential workers who just almost killed themselves going through a pandemic that frankly is not over. People got clapped and applauded for, and they got nothing else. So we've got two states worth of nurses on picket lines right now. We just settled a strike in Seattle among the teachers in Seattle. We have the longest nurses strike in history in Massachusetts while the administration seemingly just sort of sat on the sidelines. We have, the federal administration reapproving a $10 billion contract with Amazon at the same time that they're busting the union right now. So there is this. And then we have, I think a sort of a too quiescent, too risk averse, broadly speaking, and there's lots of exceptions, but, a sort of too quiescent national labor leadership, not sort of adequately tapping into the anger in the field and channeling that in a way that could lead to even more significant organizing wins right now than we've been capable of in a long time. So a lot of energy out there. Some of the independent unions are capturing it. They sometimes lack some of the skill required to get to the next step of the fight. And that's the crazy gap going on between sort of what are the national unions doing? How are they supporting the upsurge in worker organizing? And then what's the administration really doing besides a lot of rhetoric? Like, I haven't seen the president on a single picket line in the last 3 weeks, and there's been a lot of picket lines that they could have chosen to be on. So maybe that's just an opening salvo.
Oh, no, that's good. Because, all right, let's start with that. The first, I want to get to the administration. Let's start with that gap that's there where we have, the Amazon union drive was independent Amazon union drive. Starbucks has been largely, I believe, independent. This Chipotle, we're going to be talking to somebody from Lansing, Michigan, that the Teamsters helped out there, but there was also an attempt, I think, up in Maine, and Chipotle ended up shutting down the store up there. And like you say, we have 14,000 nurses on strike in Minnesota. We followed that strike in Worcester quite a bit. Both my sisters were born in that hospital, and so we
St. Vincent's,
in St. Vincent's, and they really hung tough, and it took a while. I mean, like, I feel like after like month six, Nancy Pelosi visited, and Walsh showed up around month six. Like, they seem to be serious, and so, but. Let's stick with this, the sort of the national, the relationship, because what I'm hearing you say is that the problem with the, there's two or at least two things that I've heard you say that are problematic with that, with the response from the national sort of union apparatus. It's one, independent unions and people who are new to this don't necessarily have the best practices and so can't foresee the, you know, they could use pros who are in there advising them as to, like, in my experience, this is what's going to happen next, and this is the way you deal with it. I mean, they did a great job of that with the Amazon stuff, but you know, to replicate these things, sometimes you need best practices every time. Because, and then the other problem is that there's not an ability to sort of coordinate the strength that comes in numbers that you would get on a sort of national level. Like, why? So why is that not happening in your mind?
You know, it's a little bit frustrating and a little bit tragic at the moment, and I hope it changes. So a lot of the same things that get in the way of our work are getting in the way of our work right now, which has to do with turf, ego, credit. And we don't have time for that right now. Like, icebergs are melting, Pakistan's covered in water, you know, heat waves are breaking out, Mississippi has no water. So it is time for people, for the national leadership to become more risk, like actually take some risk and let down their guard and kind of bring in this new wave of workers and actually support and facilitate and help them, not kind of put up barriers like, unless you join on the dotted line and follow our rules, we can't really work with you. There's some of that going on, which is, again, mind-boggling for me. Watching the heat that's developing in the field. And if I flash back even 2 years, to be honest, I feel like we, you know, we've had the George Floyd moment. We had 3 million people in the streets protesting around disgust and racial abuse in this country. And we had a pandemic. And for a couple of years, it was sort of like the national labor leadership, again, broadly speaking, did fail to tap into that moment. And it's sort of like the question is, when are we going to actually tap into the heat that's out there? The strikes that are happening are independent unions, independent nurses unions, the Seattle trade union is not independent. They're linked to their national union, but that's a local union. I mean, frankly, I'm working with a ton of unions in Europe where people are fashioning national strikes right now, right? We should be having national strikes in this country. And I don't want to be naive. I laugh every time someone says general strike because we're so far from being ready for that.
Right.
But it's not unreasonable to think that we could be coordinating lineup in key sectors of the economy, like the rail sector, for example, where we could be saying, as a national trade union leadership could be saying, geez, we just went through a massive pandemic that, again, is not over, by the way, but we went through an extraordinary pandemic where healthcare workers sacrificed their lives, and the national healthcare workers unions never asked people to sort of walk out and take collective action together at a moment when we really needed to. And as a result of that, we're seeing, you know, we're a month in to the mental health care worker strike against Kaiser in California. Again, that's like an independent union trying to take on Kaiser. It's a failure to rise to the moment and actually meet the energy in the field and convert it into not just like, we need two more better senators in the U.S. Senate. Like, that is not what people are going to respond to. We've got an eviction crisis. The administration hasn't dealt with the eviction crisis. We've got housing. We've got the outrageous rent increases happening. To say you're a pro for you, for the national unions and for the administration to behave like pro union, frankly, to me means pro-multiracial working class. So what does the multiracial working class need? Like, let's start there and build up to a set of demands. And there's a those demands are not being made. And there's something wrong with that. They're being made by workers who are going on strike without a lot of support all over the country. And that is the gap that's got to be closed at the national level. So the ranks are pushing. The question is, when is the national leadership going to respond in a way in kind so that we can actually make the kind of gains that the working class needs in this country and stave off the kind of fascism that we're seeing, whether it's the Swedish elections, what's going on in the UK, or right here in the United States. It's bonkers how little we're coordinating nationally to give support to people on the front lines who are desperately trying to call attention to the things that they need right now.
So if I hear you correctly, it's a failure to mobilize nationally, but in service of not just the specific demands of the particular workers that are going on strike, but rather demands that can be made of our government to provide material benefits for all workers.
Absolutely.
So for instance, there are a bunch of Teamsters who represent, or I should say the Teamsters represent at least a significant portion of the 115,000 railway workers. They could also maybe have the truckers start to say, like, yeah, I got some news for you. If those freight trains aren't running, my trucks aren't running either. And then all of a sudden, the leverage becomes not just better working conditions for railway workers who are largely outside of protections of labor law. Emma,
yeah, I want to ask you about that a little bit later, Jane.
But then the idea is that then the Teamsters could say, like, incidentally, you know, here's some legislative agenda items that we have, or, you know, maybe changes to, like, we want to see you with federal contracts say to Amazon, no dice until you pull off the union busters.
Exactly. I mean, that last one is one of the most obvious ones. I mean, Amazon is, you know, breaking the law left, right, and center in terms of abusing their worker rights. We've already had the first ruling at the National Labor Relations Board that came through a week and a half, almost 2 weeks ago now, that affirmed the election decision. It recommended throwing out all 22 of Amazon's objections, right, to that election in Staten Island. And companies already announced they're going to appeal it. And we know they're going to appeal it. And, you know, for this not to turn into an ongoing nightmare for 8,000 workers who actually overcame union busting and managed to vote to unionize, what we need is not rhetoric from Washington. We need them to say to Amazon, we're going to cancel that $10 billion contract. And when the administration gave Amazon that contract, it was late April. So it was in the middle of union busting in the second election at LDJ 5, the second facility where they were walking workers through the tightrope of one captive audience meeting after another, which is where workers must go listen to union busting rhetoric on work time. And it was a bid between Microsoft, not that I'm a huge fan of Microsoft, by the way, but it was like a bid between Microsoft, who actually has said they will allow their workers to unionize in some of their negotiations going on with the gaming firms, versus a total union buster, right? So it's like, the most effective way to speak to Amazon right now is not to have an underfunded NLRB that can't even keep up with the lawyers at Amazon. It's to say, you're not going to have, sorry, we're going to suspend the federal contract we just gave you until you actually follow the law and start negotiating, recognize the union and start negotiating with the Amazon workers. Like, these are steps that they can take, and they are not taking them. And I think that's what we need to be holding them accountable to. There's even more basic stuff, like, so the Department of Labor the other day said, oh, we're putting out an announcement to say that when you get a federal contract, you have to check a box that tells us if you're doing union busting. It's called an LM-10 form. You know, we've been demanding that they reinstitute what's called an LM-10 filing so that workers can know what union busters have been hired by a company. And the administration has yet to even reinstitute the Obama-era rules on making corporations be honest about how much they're spending on union busters. Like, that's a basic internal rulemaking issue that the administration could have taken by now and has failed to so far enact. So there's good rhetoric. We like to hear it. It's good for workers to hear that, you know, the president believes in unions, but we need action, a lot of action, and we're not seeing it yet.
And the appointments to the NLRB, I mean, they're underfunded, but doing the best they can. But now it's time to escalate and actually use the power of what the administration can and cannot do in conjunction with this. And this is also, you know, leadership is not union leadership is also not sort of stepping up and sort of like forcing the administration. And it's always about attention, right? It's like the administration can avoid a fight with Amazon. They'll do it. But the Teamsters coming in going like, we're going to cause a real, you worried about inflation numbers now? I mean, if there's no trucks and there's no trains running, you're going to worry about those. So here's what it's going to take to resolve this. Emma, go ahead.
Yeah, and let's just be clear. The point, you know, having moving Peter Robb out of the NLRB was terrific. That was like almost a day one action. It made all of us very excited. That was the former head of the general counsel at the National Labor Relations Board. You know, we were all like thrilled. You know, people in the trade union were thrilled by that move. On the other hand, we have yet to be able to because it's so underfunded, we have yet to be able to force Starbucks or Amazon to get to the table in any negotiations or actually recognize the union because the agency is starving. So then if the agency is starving and you've got, you know, they want to blame the Republicans for blocking funding that agency. I just wanted to say that's been a bipartisan defunding of that agency for the last two decades. So let's be honest about that, right? There has been, I call it in the third book, actually the fourth one's not out yet, Sam, maybe I'll come back for that. It'll be out in the winter, spring. But the third book, A Collective Bargain, the fourth one's in production. The third one, A Collective Bargain, you know, I sort of say in that the gap between I sort of frame out the party of the elite, that there's an elite strata across both the Democratic and Republican parties. Of course, they're different. One is the Republican Party's off the rails at this point. But it isn't like we should give the Democrats a pass because they have been complicit in defunding the NLRB. They've been complicit in not passing labor law reform. They've been complicit in the disruption of the Veterans Affairs Administration. I mean, there's a lot of ways in which I trace in the third book and the attack on the teachers unions, right? It's like there's been a consistency on some of the bipartisan stuff that shows class politics in America and the power of the elite corporations. And that's also true at the Fed. Like, the Fed is balancing the back of the inflation debate on the back of workers right now, not on the back of shareholders. Like, that's a labor issue. How are we solving the inflation problem? On the backs of workers or on the backs of shareholders? I prefer it be on the back of the shareholders. The Fed's actions are not separate from the administration, and we can't separate them.
Right.
Yeah, I have so many questions, but I think I'll just make this more specific to the news of the day about the railroad strike. I mean, so that could potentially be coming. I mean, we'll see if there's an agreement met. But in terms of the way that the deck is stacked against railroad workers in a unique way that it isn't for other workers, can you flesh that out? Because people under overtime protections that most federal employees would or that are more federally mandated because of this carve out for them. There's a lot of protections that they particularly don't have, and that's codified into federal law.
Yeah, it's true. Let me just back up and say the truth is I'm not an expert on the RLA, what's called the Railway Labor Act. So I can't give you the details of the Railway Labor Act the way I can on the NLRB or a lot of the state public sector law, but they do have carve outs. It's much easier for the federal administration to intervene in a way that actually strips them of some of the same rights that ordinary, quote unquote, private sector workers have. Though I will say the idea that any workers have an easy time trying to go on strike or get overtime protections or get anything at this point has been so diminished. It's crazy. But I think for me, so not an expert on the RLA specifically, and there are some carve outs they have. What I can say more generally is the idea that there's a freak out, that the news today is like a freak out about how business will be affected, how business will be disrupted. It's like, could we have one headline that says we could solve all this by having the federal administration put their thumb on the scales in a way that gets the worker, the engineers, the extra staffing that they're demanding? That's it. One solution. We don't have to talk about $2 billion a day in supply chain disruptions and Amtrak canceling national rail service outside of the Northeast Corridor. It's absurd. It's called give the damn workers what they need and the whole thing's going to be over with, and it's a lot cheaper. And that is a way to be a pro-union administration, not to sit on the side of the bosses in the supply chain debate. And the supply chain debates because we outsourced every job to China 25 years ago under Clinton. I mean, this stuff is not separate. It's cumulative. And that is what, I mean, every time we talk about supply chain issues, which is coming up in the railway strike, it's like, it's not a supply chain issue. It's called the deunionization of the American manufacturing sector and shipping jobs abroad. That's why we don't have infant formula. That's why all of it. It's just, it's like there's a siloed discussion that doesn't anchor the actions that have taken place in this country and what its 45-year degradation of workers' rights have been. And a lot of rank-and-file workers are saying, we're just going to go for it, and we hope someone throws a rope and a lifeline to us right now and helps us figure out how to get to bargaining and actually win some contracts, right? It's crazy.
Don't those headlines, though, help in terms of the workers in the sense that, like, the last thing the administration wants is those billions of dollars. I mean, you know, ostensibly they're trying to blame it on the railway workers here, but the bottom line is like the last thing that they want 2 months out from this election are those type of headlines to actually come into existence. I mean, I would imagine like those headlines, they can piece it together. Like they had the ability in the White House to figure out like, we can stop this. And I think just sort of like the image of like this looming out there is like the thing that's going to get them motivated.
I hope so. I hope so. Okay. I mean, it would be good. It would be great to see the president or the vice president on a picket line. Like there's a lot of private meetings going on. We got thousands of nurses on picket lines in two states right now frankly, actually important swing states. We just had teachers on strike in something that's less of a swing state, but it shouldn't be just directed by politics. So yeah, if they settle it in a way that calls attention to the fact that exhausted engineers need more staff, that exhausted nurses need more staff, that exhausted teachers need nurses and social workers in the schools to take care of the pandemic era crisis in all the kids from being in and out of the school. I mean, every one of these issues from St. Vincent's on has been about overworked, undercompensated, totally abused workers fighting their way from the bottom up, trying to capture the national attention so that people's lives can become sane again. And that's coupled with outrageous increases in rents all over this country, outrageous increases in premiums and healthcare costs. And so there are just a series of like these we got to close the gap here, people. If you want people excited about turning out to make sure we have, you know, more better senators and not just that, but a House, which we may lose, which I think is where the Republicans are focused, because that's where the alternate electors are going to be seated, right? It's like the power analysis is shifting, and we got to be honest about the power analysis. And are we actually tending to the real power structure analysis that corporations and capital are imposing and the hard right right now? And I don't think we are doing that. And that's a failure of, in part, national unions not holding the administration accountable, and in part, the administration that I love to listen to what they say. We just need to see more direct action, like canceling the Amazon contract until Amazon follows the law and gets to the bargaining table, for example, and using real pressure on Howard Schultz and the folks at Starbucks, where over 200 workers' shops have voted to unionize and they've yet to get to the negotiations table. That's a problem.
Well, that and I know we're up against a hard out here for you. And so that is what folks can go and check out on your video. You make a really fascinating point about a year in, 52% of new unions have yet to negotiate a contract. And the reason why management drags this out is because 12 months out, they are allowed to push for a decertification. So it's basically their second bite at trying to defeat the union before a contract comes in. And you lay out three concepts that unions need to follow in which to get that contract process in place so there can be some material benefits for those union newly unionized workers so that these decertification campaigns don't function well. I hope I summarized that well, and people can go check out those videos. We'll put a link to it. I also had a bunch of questions just about, you know, the National Labor Relations Act that, you know, we got from a listener was asking about, you know, sort of like management at these fast food restaurants don't have the ability to unionize, even though that they're, you know, just as sort of like exploited mm-hmm. as the so-called workers below them, you know, ostensibly that they are managing. But we've got to have you back and do this again.
You did a great job summarizing the video. So I'm glad you're super astute and smart. We know that already, but it also means that I was trying to clearly communicate. And yeah, I think the topics are huge right now. And I would be happy to be back to chat with you all on the show anytime. But I think you're asking all the right questions, and I think we need a lot more attention to it.
Great. Well, we'll have you back soon, and we'll pick up from where we left off. Really appreciate your time, Jane McAlevey. And also, I should say to people, like, you know, because we get calls all the time from people who are contemplating, like, I'm at a Trader Joe's. I want to start to organize here. I'm going to reading your books is a great first step. We always tell these folks, just Google Jane McAlevey and read whatever she's written, and you will learn more about organizing this stuff. So thank you so much for your time. Really,
let's talk again soon. Yeah, great.
Thanks so much.
Have a good day.
All right, folks, we're going to take we're not going to take a quick break quite yet. We got a couple of words from our sponsors. Also, just a little bit of housekeeping, house cleaning. Yesterday, we forgot to plug Mike Duncan's tour.
Oh.
Was it yesterday that we had him on?
Yep.
God, I just forget it. I don't even have the ability to like do any of that scope out time anymore.
Yes.
But Mike Duncan's on tour in October. He's going to be at the Palace of Fine Arts in San Francisco on October 4th. He is going to be the town hall in Seattle October 5th. And then he's going to be at the Wilbur Theater October 26th.
Oh.
Just like we were.
Hmm. Copycat.
Yeah. Well, whatever. I guess maybe that's where he got the
idea.
He saw.
Yeah, exactly.
Links to tickets is in our YouTube and podcast description of yesterday's and today's show. We're going to do him a solid since he's going to the Wilbur.
Hmm.
We may have to just go back there just so that I can keep saying Wilbur in that way.
Back to the Wilbur.
Folks, I've mentioned in the past, I am very, very uptight about being a victim of identity theft, of fraud, of cybercrime. That said, I also, at a drop of a hat, will engage with those text messages I'm getting now, like, hey, sorry we missed each other the other day. How's it going?
Yes.
And then I just write back, like, you know.
You're a complex figure, right? You contain multitudes when it comes to identity.
I wrote back to somebody yesterday, it's going good. I mean, but the passage of my parents is only mitigated by the huge inheritance I got. Anyways, what's up with you? Like, but the point being, very easy. I got a couple of like Geek Squad emails the other day. What these are very often are phishing exercises. And you think you may be savvy, but maybe the members of your family aren't. Well, that's why I use Aura to protect myself and, frankly, my family as well. Mm-hmm. Because my kids aren't quite as savvy as I am.
Ah.
And they are one of our sponsors today. Aura is identity theft protection, fraud monitoring, and antivirus software all combined in one easy-to-use app. Now, you may have one of these services already, but if you don't have all the tools, it's like locking the front door, but leaving the back door wide open. Those who have had their identity stolen are obviously shocked, dismayed, and it is huge, huge pain in the ass. And it also just feels horrible. One day, you're logging into your email account. You see your password was changed just hours ago, maybe from some location and God knows where. And then you start getting notifications, activity from your bank and your credit cards. Scary. Unfortunately, it's a reality for one American every 14 seconds. Thankfully, Aura monitors the dark web for your emails, passwords, and social security numbers and sends alerts fast right to your phone or your computer via email. when I entered in, I've mentioned this before, I entered in the email address I use for a lot of accounts. Half a dozen breaches come up.
Oh my God.
And in fact, for like most of those, like half of those accounts, I didn't even remember I had signed up for those things.
Right.
But sometimes you may use a derivation or the same password associated with that email for other accounts. That's what they do. And that's why it tells you immediately you got to go change it. Or also gives you near real-time alerts on suspicious credit inquiries. Like if somebody's going to try and take out a car loan or, God forbid, a mortgage or a credit card in your name. You can protect your family and yourself from identity theft at aura.com/majority. And when you sign up right now, Aura is going to give you a 2-week free trial with my link. So you can see for yourself how many times Aura finds you or your family members personal info on the dark web. And if you sign up, let me know in the comments below if your personal information has been compromised. You will not regret checking. Again, that's aura.com, aura.com/majority to try Aura for free for 14 days. And we have a new sponsor, fan of the show. It is IAC Laser Engraving. It is a leftist-owned worker collective started by a long-term listener, Ryan Lubin, in September of 2021. His company is democratically structured. They ensure that any hierarchies are justified and efficient and thought out. They used only sustainably sourced materials coupled with extremely energy efficient laser technology to bring you unique products that you're not going to find anywhere else. This stuff is crazy. Hold on one second. These are just two of them. And you should also know that like your purchase of when you buy one of their things, it's a one of a kind product. Also goes directly to supporting a business model that is structured around compassionate and worker-centered care as opposed to the more traditional and predatory authoritarian ones found throughout capitalism. All right, check this out. I got two of the things here. It is made out of wood. It is an astronaut. Is that coming across there? And you
That's
can see
badass.
That it's
multiple colors.
Layers.
Yeah.
I have a lot of interest in woodworking. I could never make this because you need to have like laser cutting things, and I imagine it's a computer. I don't know.
So is it different depths that are making the colors there?
Eight layers of hand painted, hand glued basswood and a eucalyptus.
Oh.
It comes with a stand that I have over there, so you can it can be or it can be easily mounted onto the wall. This
that's like perfect for. I mean, you can hang it anywhere, but like your kid's room or something
this
like
is
that.
Where that's going.
Oh yeah.
I was like, I can't take it home yet, but yeah, this is going in Saul's room. And this one goes for $75. You can check it out at iaclaser.com. iaclaser.com. In addition to this astronaut plate piece, they offer over 60 other 3D layered mandalas, animals, mythical creatures, and they have custom options that are available too. And let me just show this one other thing. I got other products from them, but today I just want to show this. I mean, I love this here. It's locks. What is it when you open it up? It is a wood-based puzzle. I don't know if you can see this. This is the image that it comes out. Gorgeous. But it's wood-based. So it is both like, and it's all of this stuff is handcrafted, or laser cut as it is. And each puzzle is made with sustainably sourced eucalyptus. They use a high definition UV printer to render each image onto wood, and then it's cut into the desired amount of pieces. There are over 30 different puzzle images to choose from, including images and paintings from local Ohio leftist artists. And a variety of different puzzle sizes ranging from 99 to 500 plus pieces. Check it out, folks. This thing comes with it in a felt lined box. It's designed by them, includes a latch. It's pretty awesome. Visit iaclasers.com. Order yours today. Check out all their different products, actually, because they have frames, they have a bunch of stuff. Enter in the coupon code MAJORITY10 at purchase, and you receive a 10% discount on all of their amazing products. Check them out. Great company, really unique gift items. Time to start thinking about as we go into fall. For me, I like to get my Hanukkah presents very early.
Yeah.
Back in the day, nothing better than getting that stuff done. But also make great gifts. This is a great gift
Yeah, if you start early, right? Like you can
born,
space
maybe
it
I'll
out.
Get this exactly.
Not so stressful when it comes to December.
So check it out.
Yeah.
IACLaser.com. We'll put a link to that in YouTube and in our podcast description. All right, now we got to just take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking to TJ Kitchen, organizing director for the Teamsters Joint Council, number 43. On the organizing of a Chipotle in Lansing, Michigan. And it is the first one to actually, the union actually certified.
Yep.
So we'll be right back after this. All right, we're back. We had a little technical difficulties, but we have successfully gotten TJ Kitchen, organizing director for the Teamsters Joint Council number 43 out of Michigan on the line. TJ, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, so give us a little bit of the backstory. The Chipotle in Lansing is the first to unionize. There was a union vote, I know, that took place up in Maine and at a Chipotle's, and the company shut that store down almost immediately. Maybe give us a little bit of the context on that to the extent that you're aware of it, and then we'll talk about Lansing.
Okay, I wasn't really involved in anything in Maine, so I just want to comment a little bit on it. I was told that they were going to file a petition and that it was shut down before they actually even had a vote. So I'm not really sure how far they got with that.
Okay.
The group had done a walkout and things like that. So they handled theirs a little different than we handled ours.
All right. So tell us, like, how did you handle yours? Now, you don't work at Chipotle. You work for the Teamsters, right?
Correct. Yep. I work for Joint Council 43.
Okay, so how did the Teamsters get involved? Tell us the story of how Chipotle's first union basically got formed.
Right, I believe it was back in late February, early March. A few of the workers from Chipotle in Lansing reached out to us and asked if we'd be interested in talking about sitting down and trying to organize with them. That there was a group. About three or four that had already talked and had an idea of what they wanted to do. And we sat down and basically had three or four meetings about what we thought was possible and how we would handle it. And then we started meeting with the folks, you know, in groups, one-on-one, and talking about their concerns and the things they wanted to change and what we thought we could do. And then we just got cards signed the old-fashioned way and filed with the NLRB and did an election.
So I've done a little, reading on the backstory. It was Atulia Dorolaski and Harper McNamara, I think, were at least two of the folks who started, you know, who got together. Do you know, did they meet with other unions? I'm curious as to how that process goes, because they're basically looking for an entity that I would imagine has best practices and resources.
I do know that they reached out to a few and maybe had meetings or conversations with others, but after our meeting, they decided they wanted to go with the Teamsters.
Did you get a sense of like what it was that you guys were able to offer them that made them sort of realize, like, okay, this is the best way to achieve this goal?
I think the time we spent with them and the diversity we have within the Teamsters and the different crafts that we're in, they just felt that we had the best history to go for something new.
Can you talk a bit about the history of that location in terms of like the attempted union busting before Lansing became the first successful vote for in Chipotle's history?
We basically kept the whole campaign underground, and once we filed, the company did have conversations with some of the employees. They ended up bringing in a third party that they called basically like a labor educator to
talk to the folks.
And we were fortunate though with the young group we were working with. They were very educated. They spent a lot of time. They were very engaged. It was good work with them, and they were. We told them what to expect, and they were up for it. And what was nice was a lot of the things we told them that were going to happen did happen. So they realized that this is kind of how the game's played.
That is, we just had a conversation with Jane McAlevey about what a sort of established union can bring to the table for people who are trying to organize, and a lot of it is just exactly what you've just articulated, the idea that you guys have experience, you know what to expect, you can help prepare them for it. Let me ask you, I mean, I imagine you've done a lot of these, like where you've met with people looking to unionize and you've basically pitched the Teamsters and because you guys have know-how. How long have you been doing that?
I've been with the Teamsters for over 25 years. I started out as a beer truck driver in Detroit here. And for about the last 2.5-3 years, I've been working with the organizing department. Did a lot of volunteer organizing before that. So
are you noticing like a difference in who in the amount of people that are coming to you guys and the sort of just the, I don't know, the just the nature of them, like how amenable they are to unions? Have you noticed any change over the past couple of years, or I guess prior to that, over the past, let's say, decade, in terms of like people's perspective on unions and their understanding of the dynamics?
I think the thing we're experiencing now is we've got a lot younger groups reaching out, a lot different industries reaching out. And then, it takes time to put these campaigns together and do these drives and elections. And you just need groups that want to be engaged. And that was what was great about Chipotle, is a lot of people now have seen that if you put the time and effort in, you can accomplish it.
And what are the main issues for Chipotle, or are they, for these workers, are they any different from maybe other Chipotles, or are they different from, I don't know, McDonald's or Starbucks? I mean, is there something particularly unique about what they're looking for, or is it what are the issue sets, the stuff that they're hoping that the union's going to provide for them?
I think a couple of the issues that they were most concerned about was, you hear a lot about staffing, but it wasn't as much the staffing, it was the scheduling of the staff. And then, the younger worker wants more of a voice at the job. They want input. And clearer and better working conditions.
Will you elaborate on the staffing thing? Because I think there's a lot of people who, may be listening, who don't, and maybe there's more of a problem with people of my generation, but they don't sort of realize like, hey, wait a second, it doesn't have to be this way. Whatever the scheduling issues are or the way that they're being treated as workers, I think a lot of people often think like, well, this is just the way it is, as opposed to it doesn't have to be that way. Can you give us a sense of like what kind of issues that these workers at the Chipotle found unreasonable and then took action to stop it?
One of their main issues with the scheduling was the amount of time or the days that people are working when they thought that they could be scheduled differently with the amount of staff that they do have and be able to produce, a better outcome.
And management just wasn't listening, I guess.
And not clearly enough.
Right. And so where are you guys at in terms of a contract? Like how quickly do you guys want to get into a contract to sort of lock in the gains and to show the members of this newly formed union shop that there's benefits to having a union?
Well, as you know, sometimes the first contract can take a little bit of time, but I think the letters have already been sent out to set up dates and start negotiations with the company. So there's a waiting period after the election, but that's passed now, and the letters have been sent out, and I think they're putting together dates, and the group's getting together and putting surveys together or the changes that we're going to propose.
So what happens in terms of like other Chipotles? Like where, like what are the, do you as an organizer basically put out word to other locals, you know, in Michigan or across the country and say like, if you've got a Chipotle's, here's the, you know, here's the way they, you know, because I would imagine as experienced as you are, you're learning something about Chipotle and how they're going to respond that has value to future Chipotles that want to organize.
Oh, for sure. If we get outreach from other Chipotle restaurants, we'll definitely communicate amongst ourselves on how things were handled or what to expect so we can strategize best to help the people that want to be members.
And what do you guys do to like to reach out? Do you just wait for people to come to you, or do you guys start now, like, or does this, you know, this crew from Lansing, do they, I don't know, do they head over to Flint and say like, you know, we just did this in Lansing, or they go down to Detroit and they, we just did this in Lansing? I mean, how does it work?
Yeah, there's various ways right now. I mean, yeah, we reach out to people. You know, we're looking to expand on things. But also, with this being as unique as it was, we've got people reaching out to us from other locations. And also, between social media, all the different platforms, you know, you don't have to live right next to somebody or work with somebody to communicate like you used to. And it's really, it's kind of helped. We're getting a lot more outreach that way.
And what's happening? Like, you know, how do you guys, I guess I'm curious as to like, are there ideas or plans or people starting to talk within the context of the leadership of the Teamsters? And I guess, you know, to the extent that, you know, maybe it's more localized leadership that you have access to and get a sense, but are people starting to talk about like, you know, leveraging these smaller organized groups into, I don't know, bigger asks across the state, across the country?
And, you know, I mean, I think we're so early on with this Chipotle one and just starting negotiations with the first ones. I mean, right now, we're just exploring all the options.
Yeah, I imagine you don't necessarily want to be too specific about what comes next.
No, we still have a lot to put together as a team.
If you were to give advice for people at, I don't know, Chipotle's around the country, or for that matter, other restaurants, or for that matter, any other workshops, like if they're starting out and they're, you know, I was reading this story in Slate about Dorlasky and McNamara talking about listening to Hassan Piker and you know, getting an idea of like, we don't need to take this. What are the first, I don't know, two or three things that you would recommend that they do? Like, is there, obviously, you'd recommend contact your local Teamsters, but are there other things that they should be doing in the meantime that are, you know, sort of best practices that somebody who hasn't had any experience in this might not know about?
Well, talk amongst your coworkers. Don't be afraid to talk about it amongst your coworkers outside of work. There's strength in numbers, and you need to educate yourself a little bit about what's possible. And if you want something, you can't be afraid. You got to go for it. And it's as much as we're getting outreach, you know, there's still a little bit of fear out there from employers, you know, about the anti-union tactics.
What are some of the union busting tactics outside of some of these, this particular example, that you would say people need to be looking out for if they're thinking about trying to organize with their coworkers just to say, hey, this won't be all right.
You should just say if the company brings a third party in or the company themselves tell you things, double check the facts. Call a local union around you or go on the NLRB website. Check the facts of what's being told to make sure it's right. We've seen a lot of things out there that have been misconceptions.
Mm. Where, and you mentioned, like, you know, people should get, they should educate themselves a little bit. If somebody comes up to you and asks, where do I educate myself? Where do you point them?
Well, I've got a lot of information. I try to sit down and have conversations with them, see what their wants and needs are, see what they have. Also, you can look at the NLRB website. Google's fantastic today. I mean, people can get all kinds of information off it. If you want to spend the time, you can find it today.
All right. Well, great. Well, TJ Kitchen, Organizing Director for the Teamsters Joint Council, number 43. Really appreciate your time today. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, folks. That completes the free portion of the program. Oh, well, let's do this. Should we do? We'll do this. This video.
We're going backwards.
Yeah, we're going backwards today. This is. We talked about this yesterday. We were sort of. There was a mix of like, is Graham this stupid?
Yeah.
Like to have done this, and it sort of feels like he was freelancing. This is one of those things where, you know,
I mean, he looks like he's freelancing right there. He looks like
looks
that
like
meme.
He's going through it.
He looks like that meme of Don Draper when he comes up blackout drunk to give the pitch to Life Cereal, like with his hair all messed up.
Or there's that like character with alcoholism, I think Duck or whatever.
Duck. Yeah.
This is what he looks like.
Just disheveled, sweaty. Right. Matt said before the show, it looked like he just came back from a 30-minute bout with diarrhea.
Well, but the question is like, you know, what motivated him to do this? Like, I think, I mean, because he is getting like slammed by all like McConnell, like all the Republican operatives. Like, I mean, he's just getting hammered because it was clear what he was trying to do, which was he was trying to sort of like create some standard to prove that we're not extremist abortion banners. And it almost felt like he was not aware of like how the conversation was going. And it's really just one of those classic, try not to think about an elephant,
yeah,
you know? And it's just like, why are you reminding people that you guys are in favor of a federal abortion ban, even if you happen to think it's not that bad?
When you've been saying the reason that you're fine with the precedent being overturned is because of the fact that states should be able to make this determination. That was their fig leaf.
It's both.
Yeah.
Like, mixed messages on that accord, and also just a dumb message to say, like, we're going to present an abortion ban, but here he is introducing it, and we'll talk a little more about it after.
What would you say to somebody like me who found out that their son had an anomaly that would be compatible with life in 16 weeks?
Pause it for 1 second. It might be a little bit difficult to hear the question, but the reporter is saying he's trying to leave, right? And she's saying, well, what do you say to someone, and I think she says like me, who found out that they had a problem with their pregnancy 16 weeks out, and maybe it was an ectopic pregnancy. I couldn't hear exactly what she was saying. And they need to get an abortion in that instance. Like, what do you say to that? And here he is, like, oh.
What would you say to somebody like me who found out that their son had an anomaly that would be compatible with life in 16 weeks? I have regular appointments, I did everything I'm right, and at 16 weeks we found out that our son was likely not live. When he was born, he lived for 8 days.
Yeah.
He bled from every orifice of his body, but we were allowed to make that choice for him.
Yes,
you would be robbing that choice from those women. What do you say to someone like
that? Here's what I would say. The world pretty much has spoken on this issue. The developed world has said at this stage into the pregnancy, the child feels pain, and we're saying we're going to join the rest of the world and not be like Iran. As to your particular case, there'll be exceptions for life of the mother and rape and incest.
There are exceptions in this bill.
Well, ma'am, this there were 55,000 abortions after the 15-week period, and I think we're resolved to get America back in line with the rest of the world, and we won't know where America is until we vote, until we debate. And so to my Democratic friends, you're going around calling all of us every name you can think of. We're a bunch of wackos. Your idea is wacko, not ours.
All right, pause for a second.
Let's vote.
Pause for a second. I want to take this part second, although it is amazing. Like, you think I'm crazy? Oh, I'll show you crazy.
Are you sure you don't want to wait until there's a wall of women behind you to say what you want to say here, Sam?
Right, exactly.
Is that the offensive line?
Yeah, exactly.
I know, right.
Yeah, I'm just leading these ladies. Here we go. First off, yesterday we dealt with this question of, like, in line with the rest of the world, 15 weeks. Germany has a 12-week ban. The exceptions are if the pregnant person makes the determination that her physical or mental health is in peril, that is all you need. In other words, the exceptions are determined by essentially the request of the pregnant person as to ending the abortion. So to say 15 weeks, it's irrelevant. It's apples and oranges there. In fact, if he's so game on it, that's the way we should do it. Let's just adopt the same standards that Germany has, and also bring in all the access that comes with a national healthcare program.
That's the thing, is like they're able to make that request and have that relationship with their doctor because of a universal nationalized healthcare program. And it's also just, I mean, different context culturally. In the United States, abortion has been being attacked and the right to an abortion for decades at this point. So a woman going to her doctor in Mississippi and saying, I need an abortion after this 15 weeks based on these states' rights, and now if this federal restriction goes into place, that's very different context than in European countries where they have nationalized healthcare.
And just to set a little bit more context for the German example, from The Guardian, June 2022, Germany scraps Nazi-era law that barred doctors' abortion ads. Majority vote ends law banning doctors from offering information about abortion procedures.
Yeah, I mean, he's just lying in terms of aligning us with the rest of the world. And then B, I don't know if you catch this, but there are no exceptions in what he has proposed because he wants to have debates about them. It's also amazing how he doesn't address the actual question that was given to him, which was like, what do you tell women coming in with 16 weeks in with ectopic pregnancies? Remember, there was about 45,000 ectopic pregnancies in the country last year. What do you tell them? And, you know, we read story after story, two or three yesterday. They're denying cancer care to women who are pregnant because the first step in cancer care, when you're going to have to provide chemo or radiation, is to abort the fetus and to end the pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And they are basically waiting until the cancer gets worse so that you can make a legal argument that it crosses the legal threshold of a threat to the mother. And they're going to err on the side of having the mother be essentially closer to life-threatening than before. That's the choice that
protects us from legal liability. And like, one, I thought it was fascinating to see how much like an angry, bitter man Lindsey Graham is, as that female reporter, I assume she's female, is asking that question about her own personal experience. He's like, just seething, trying to get through it. And say, like, he wants to have debate on these exemptions on the floor and where you're going to draw the line. Please do.
Oh,
you want to see these state? What we've been seeing coming out of these state houses and these state senates that we've been covering on this show? Let's do it with the Republican senators. I want to see Tommy Tuberville out there. I want to see Mitch McConnell making a certain case because he's certainly reluctant to being quoted. Like, I want this to be a states' rights issue.
You know,
issue. So make them make that case.
Lindsey Graham famously said, like, you can have a vote on Medicare for all. We should have one right now. We should do that right now because I'd like to see what's going to happen with these people. I'll tell you something. Chuck Schumer should bring this ban up.
Oh, yeah.
Let's
hear what Graham you have to say.
Let's make every Republican in the Senate vote for or against this ban. Let's make Ron Johnson vote for it. Let's make every Republican running in this country, make them vote for or against this ban. This is a perfect wedge issue.
Same with gay marriage too, but to more of an extent. Yeah. This, given how this is galvanized,
gay marriage.
Voters.
The only difference is the gay marriage, protecting marriage equality, has an opportunity to actually pass and get locked in. And I think Schumer is trying to make sure that that happens. But all right, so let's listen to Lindsey Graham claim, I'm not the crazy one.
Oh, there's more to this.
Yeah, you're the crazy one. I'm not the crazy one.
I just like the way she's like, what would you say to someone like me? And it's like, the response I'd have to women who have ectopic pregnancies is only if they also called me a wacko. And then I'd respond to that.
Oh, yeah. Did you call me a wacko? Yeah, everybody says I'm wacko. I'm introducing this legislation to prove I'm not a wacko.
We're resolved to get America back in line with the rest of the world. And we won't know where America is until we vote, until we debate. And so to my Democratic friends, you're going around calling all of us every name you can think of. We're a bunch of wackos. Your idea is wacko, not ours. Let's vote. Let's vote. Give me a chance to vote on this bill. We'll take our considerations and we'll vote. Now, I guarantee if we have a debate on the floor of the United States Senate where we can explain what we're doing versus what they would do, we'll do really well with the American people. And over time, God willing, we're going to be like the rest of the world and not like Iran at the federal level when it comes to abortion. We're going nowhere. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, one of those people standing behind him, I mean, I'm sure a lot of them are crisis actors, but you got to imagine one is a staffer who could look up what goes on in Iran, because I don't know if he's having some type of episode or if he simply remembers from like years and years ago. This is from June 24th, 2022 on the Iran Wire. With abortion already banned, Iran begins to criminalize doctors.
He has it the other way. He wants it to be more like Iran as opposed to less like it.
Like, right, it's like
he's also just obsessed with Iran, right?
Well, yeah, right, of course.
Well, because I think they're like
it's
sort
too
of...
for me. I'm not crazy. Yeah. The mullahs are crazy.
They're jealous of their reactionary theocracy.
Yeah,
exactly.
And those wires got crossed for him.
Man. You know, in Iran, you wouldn't be able to ask me this question.
And that would be honestly a blessing. But
my job easier.
He's like, this is reminiscent also of the Rick Scott thing, too, where Rick Scott came out with his tax plan and McConnell wanted him to just shut the hell up because you're ruining the whole grift that we're pulling off. We're trying to pen that we don't actually want to cut taxes for the wealthy and raise them on the poor. You just came out and said it. Same with Lindsey Graham. This, we were supposed to say this was states' rights, and now you're just coming out and saying it. But they're pissed.
Well, I mean,
he was up there basically, you know, without any of those Republican men, the only people that count.
To be fair, Lindsey Graham has said it's supposed to be states' rights. Let's go back now, folks. I know a lot of people on the show younger than me may not remember. This is from way back in August. I think it's the first week of August in 2022. I'm not sure if you remember this.
Whoa.
This is over, well, I guess just exactly 5 weeks ago. So here we go.
Saying that the 2015 Supreme Court decision that made same-sex marriage, the law of the land nationally, should be overturned?
No, I am saying that I don't think it's going to be overturned.
Nor should it be?
Well, you know, that'd be up to court. The reasoning, I think, could be attacked, but the point I'm trying to make is I've been consistent. I think states should decide the issue of marriage and states should decide the issue of abortion. I have respect for South Carolina. South Carolina voters here, I trust, to define marriage and to deal with the issue of abortion, not nine people on the court. That's my view.
How far down should that, I mean, how wide should that go? How many more issues should that
we're
go to? For example,
about
Loving versus Virginia? That
all right, we don't need to hear anymore. I mean, you know, he made the point right there, but he couldn't help himself. He's going to come out. And I've been saying from day one, they're going to do a federal ban on abortion. If he's bringing up this bill with a Democratic Congress, just imagine what's going to happen with the Republican one. I think Chuck Schumer should just say right now, here you go, bud. You wanted a vote? Let's take a vote. Oh, no amendments. Let's just do this. Up or down. Ban abortion or not, 15 weeks. And make every single one of those Republicans take a vote on that. Plant their flag and let every one of their constituents know where they stand.
Man, I think they should do them. I should think that they should stretch it out in terms of debate on amendments, though, because then you can get the craziest of the crazy. You can get in that, like, the more there's clips coming out of the national senators, federal senators on the floor debating about women, I don't know. I think the better.
Now let's make Herschel Walker talk about it on the campaign trail and Dr. Oz and all those folks.
Oh, they're going to. I mean, Walker, I think, came out. He's the only person who came out and was like, yeah, no, I'm for it.
And I'm using, I like that.
That's going to change in about 5 minutes, I can assure you.
They're trying to go for the kill in New Hampshire with, like, Bolduc funding his campaign. And so Maggie Hassan has an easier road to re-election. Then do it in terms of hammering them on the legislative front in the Senate. Go.
Here is...
Let's take a break.
We'll go to the fun half, and then we'll do Mitch McConnell's reaction to Lindsey Graham.
Almost gave away another freebie.
I know it. God. See, I got my hammy is pulled, and it's driving me crazy, and so I can't even think straight. Folks, just a reminder, it's your support that makes... What's that? Where'd that moth come from?
Okay.
Did you really get that scared?
Yeah, it was right in front, right over my head.
I'm just seeing it now as well.
It just died. Something like that. Folks, it's your support that makes the show possible.
I wish that wasn't
on
camera.
You can help this show survive and thrive and also keep all the critters out of the office by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. And when you become a member, like I say, you not only help the show survive and thrive, you also get the free show, free of commercials, and you get access to the fun half.
Maybe in the fun half, I'll tell a story of my one-time interaction with a rat.
All right.
I did not react well to these kinds of things.
I'm not surprised by that. again, if you are somebody who's going through some particular financial hardship, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Just put in the subject line membership, and we will help you out. Just got to give us a little bit of time. I know we're behind on some of those emails. We will get there. I promise you. I promise you. It will happen. Join themajorityreport.com for those of you not feeling a financial pinch but enjoying the program on a fairly regular basis. Also, don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Great coffee, folks. Don't sleep on it. Madison, Wisconsin, co-op. Gotta love it. Also, check out the AM Quickie, amquickie.com. Get the top news stories in your email box every morning by 9 a.m.-ish. From a left perspective, check that out. Emma, week two. NFL previews.
Yes. Well, recap this time. So on ESPN, on the Majority Report yesterday, Bradley and I recapped the Russell Wilson getting cooked by his former team in Seattle, which I took great enjoyment in. Not a Russell Wilson fan, given his general corniness and loserness. Sorry, I really should go less hard on that. But we also did other...
very upset Broncos and Seahawks fans.
I understand, but he sucks as a person. And the Giants won. There were a lot of other games that we recapped. We talked about who's the best receiver in football. It's a two-man race between Ja'Marr Chase and Justin Jefferson, in my opinion, and it's not particularly close. And more, we took your calls. And on Thursday, Bradley and I will be doing, and I think this will be a weekly thing, just a half hour, same time on the Majority Report channel where we give our locks for the weekend. It's not gambling advice, but it's just a fun little competition between us. I went 3-0 last week, and Bradley went 1-2.
And the only one I got was for the Jets game that I was at.
And they lost.
I had them losing.
Yeah, so I was pretty happy with that 3-0 start. So check that out. And we're also on Apple and Spotify now.
YouTube.com/ESPN show.
Yeah, and, for clips.
Go on the MR website or Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and we're all
good work.
All there.
Yeah.
And Matt, you had a show as well last night.
Yep. Left Reckoning. We had Aaron Kleinman on, and we also talked about Minneapolis nurses and MAGA communists or MAGA patriots, patriot communists, and that sort of stupidity that is doing a lot of things. Entirely online. So that's patreon.com/leftreckoning to get access to that, where we actually we watch a Ken Starr clip that we're going to watch in the fun half here, I think.
Yep.
Oh, nice.
We should mention that Jean-Luc Godard died. And so rest in peace. Obviously had a lot of... there's not a lot of, like, I probably come up with like maybe a dozen filmmakers who had the most impact. He's definitely obviously on that list.
Yeah, Breathless, I think, kind of essentially laid the groundwork for like 50 years of filmmaking.
Yep, without a doubt.
I think I've only seen Contempt, maybe.
And also, Ken Starr died. Boo-doo, boo-doo, boo-boo. We will talk more about that in the fun half. You can piece those two things together. Back to back, Ken Starr died. We'll talk about it in the fun half. You know, I'm sure his family's upset. 646-257-3920. We'll be right back after this.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now. But I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts. Wait a second. Hold on for a second.
The Majority Report.
Fun half. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Fun half. Matt.
Who?
Fun half.
What is up, everyone?
Fun half.
Nomi Key.
You did it.
Fun half.
Let's go, Brandon.
Fun half.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this, today?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go for that.
Libertarians.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say.
857-210-3501.
One half.
3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop. You can call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the wheat being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. Yeah. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
wow,
folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late. And the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.